This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. If you're interested in attending one of the Renegade University weekend events that are discussed in this episode, we have two coming up. The first will be in Los Angeles, the weekend of February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and the second will be in Washington, D.C., and that'll be March 15th to the 17th. We are offering an early bird special that expires this Thursday at midnight. You can get 20% off either of the weekend events if you sign up right now. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Michael Brooks is the host of The Michael Brooks Show. He's also one of the most thoughtful and interesting people I know who's doing political journalism. As you'll see, he and I have a lot in common, although I stopped being a socialist right around the time that he became one. I was very pleased that, despite my apostasy, Michael was still willing to talk to me. This is my interview with Michael Brooks. So I've been trying to build bridges with the left, you know, or rebuild the bridges I've had with the left by having people I consider to be worth speaking to on the show who are on the left, who are serious leftists, and there aren't that many of them. And so what I do is, I think it's very important to treat your guests very well. So today what I did was I made sure that my guest today, Michael Brooks, stand outside of my house in the rain for more than an hour so that he would have to wear my shirt during the interview. Because Michael and I have a lot in common. You know, we're both children of the counterculture. We've both been socialists. Michael still is, but I'm not. We both like our black culture a whole lot. We're both dudes, white dudes. And now that he's wearing my shirt, he looks just like me. So we're pretty much merged. And I'm glad to have treated him the way a guest should be treated. And I'm glad to finally make Michael my own. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Pleasure. It's good to be here. Good to be here.
No, Michael actually is one of, I think, the smartest and most interesting people on the serious left in the United States, in my view. I think there's maybe a dozen of you that I would count in there, maybe not even that many, but I've been really impressed with your intelligence, your savvy, which is unusual, not just among leftists, but among political people generally. And I think
that is kind of weird.
You seem to have like a street savviness about you. And plus, I also detect a fair amount of emotional intelligence, which I highly value and I find lacking among all political people.
Yes.
Right? Definitely. And so you came to my attention, I don't know, like about an hour ago. You certainly came to my attention an hour ago.
Wow.
When I was getting frantic texts from my producer. By the way, and I want to also be really clear, it was the producer's fault for you being left outside in the rain.
Really?
Always blame the workers.
Yeah, okay. Well, I practiced that in my personal life. You know, I don't believe the personal is political at all.
Yeah,
so my macro political commitments have totally, if you want to throw your producer under the bus, that's great.
Yeah, no, it's always the workers' fault. Mostly because they're lazy. I don't know if you know that, but the workers tend to be lazy.
No. Everybody tends to be
no,
lazy.
I'm a dick and I lose track of time and I'm late to everything and I suck. So actually, I'm going to convert to socialism to make it up to you.
It's time.
Reconvert.
You just need to get over whatever your stuff is with your parents. And
exactly.
Be a socialist. I see it.
Oh, you've talked to Connor Kilpatrick, apparently.
I've not talked to Connor Kilpatrick, but I've talked to other people. I think this is a very common, we're just like, Thaddeus just needs to get over his parents' stuff and then he'll get some good politics.
Awesome.
Again.
Okay. So this is why you're really here. Because
that's right.
A lot of people don't know, there's like this thing that I'm calling the Brooklyn left.
Right.
You know, kind of the Brooklyn communist or socialist left. Right. Some of it's like capital C communist, like the Chapo guys, Chapo Trap House. Some of them are more, I think, you're not quite capital C.
Although capital. I don't know. I don't know if they're capital C.
Come on.
Capital C.
They're at least, they're capital C.
If they're capital C, then I'm definitely capital C.
Oh, okay. So, so I've had my run-ins with the Brooklyn communist left in recent years. I haven't talked to many of them in a long time, but the last communication I had with any of them was a nice little exchange with this guy, Connor Kilpatrick, who I think, is he still managing editor at Jacobin?
I think he still is at Jacobin, yeah.
He's one of the editors at Jacobin magazine, which is one of the kind of center, like the hub. I think it's the kind of the hub.
Very important. Of this. I do less of a Bhaskar.
Yeah, right.
He's one of my regulars on my show.
Right, who's the publisher of it. Yeah. And it's, Jacobin for me is about 50%. I like a lot, 50% makes me crazy. But anyway, so Connor and I were arguing about something, this is many years ago, I can't remember what it was, and he at one point said, you just need to get over your little Oedipal struggle with your parents. And I said, I'm looking forward to meeting you in person someday, Connor. Michael, do you happen to know where he lives, by the way?
I actually flew all the way across the country. I don't know where Connor lives. I think I met Connor once. He's a really nice guy. I've liked his writing, but Connor's one of the, he's one of the guys that I know least, but I know a lot of people, but I'm also like not on the scene that much in a certain way. Like some of my social life has very little to do with, politics.
Really? What do you do?
I mean, honestly, I do work constantly.
Right.
I am in a space like that.
Right. Me too.
I go to the gym. I've started going back.
Me too.
To work out a lot. Which
See?
Feels great.
Just so, like me.
Synchronized. Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. This is a while ago now, but like, I don't know, go to Trinidad for Carnival.
Wow.
I like to travel. But in some ways, like, I don't know. I mean, this isn't a perfect example, but like I do Woke Bros with my friend Waz, which is for my patrons and the Count the Dings patrons. And we talk about politics a lot, but Waz is also a sports guy. And so I'll do a live show with those guys soon. And so that's a little bit more of like a, I don't know, like a hip hop, pop culture, sports world.
And some
of my kind of social life is a little bit more in that zone.
Right. You like your hoops and you like your hip hop, right?
I like my hoops and my hip hop.
Yeah.
I also, it's fine. I do like that, but I also like, I mean, I like a very broad experience of life. I mean, I've still got my hippie contingent. I've still got my meditation world.
Meditation.
I've still got my, you know, there's the ayahuasca tip, which I'm not so heavy on. I have explored, but you know, I'm very interested in people who are are interesting, who are really living and doing different things. I think that enriches, you know, it definitely enriches the content, how I look at things.
Don't you think it's a problem for political people in general that they don't tend to be interested in things outside of politics?
This is going to piss a lot of people off.
Do it.
And I'm going to quote Tony Blair, of all people, who is sort of like one of my
enemies.
He's totally an enemy, but he's also like, if I was a sociopath, I think I would be quite similar to Tony Blair. And he, in one of his speeches, you know,
a debonair fascist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely. I totally see it in myself. And he said, you know, like, you got to be a fully paid up member of the human race to succeed in politics.
Hmm.
And I was like, yeah, I think that's true.
Hmm.
And I think that there is something and what he meant by that in a very shallow, you know, he used some very kind of grating example about, like, you know, like, he was going to meet with his election agent for his first campaign. And they kind of were like, told him to shut up because they were watching the soccer match. And he took, you know, that was the big lesson. Like, you know, I'm leaving university where everything is, you know, politics, politics, politics. But in the real world, even political professionals want to finish the game before they figure out, you know, the door knocking strategy or whatever. And I think that there is something, I actually think particularly on the left, because my conception of left politics, I mean, is absolutely dealing with and eliminating, you know, basic human suffering, which totally does not need to exist and can be taken care of, in my view, 100%. But it also has to do with, like, the idea that once you sort of take away the unnecessary and cruel suffering of like dire poverty or not having health care or this type of thing, you get to, you know, explore yourself as a full human. And so I think that like we should be doing that, even as we're also diagnosing and dealing with all the things that we don't like. We need to synchronize that. So we need to, you know, and I mean, it's also just my temperament, my style. I like comedy. I like a lot of different things.
Yeah, I love that you said that about the consequences, the positive consequences of economic or financial security.
Yes.
Right? And that's one of the main arguments for UBI, Universal Basic Income.
I'm very skeptical of UBI, but yes, I think that that would be
I like
great,
it. Yeah. I think it's probably going to be an economic catastrophe, but I'm still going to support it anyway. Until I'm proven wrong.
Well, I like that kind of thing.
No, I don't know. I just don't know yet, but I like the idea of it. It could be a very bad idea economically. But no, I do think the argument's pretty powerful. When you have financial security, life is good. Life can be good. It's easy for life to be good. It's easier. It's possible to enjoy all the things you talk about.
And also, and find the challenges that are real and product, you know, like the things that are, you know, that are genuinely hard about life, right, as well. And I'm definitely, I think that there's another great middle ground too. Like, I don't think we need to, I think obviously people are diverse and have many different interests and capacities and so on and so forth. But also, I generally like most people I encounter. Hmm. I think most people have interesting things about and in them. And I want them to be able to access and do things with that. And it's fundamental to my politics, but it's also fundamental to how I want to experience the world, I want to relate to people, places, and things.
Yeah, so, I mean, we agree that when people are financially secure, life is good, and I want that for people too, right? And the only question is, how do we get that, right? What's the most effective means to do that? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we get people healthcare? How do we get people housing? Mm-hmm. How do we get people adequate amount of money, right, to live with? The other thing you and I have in common, by the way, I didn't mention, is a history of financial insecurity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you've talked about this, right?
Yes.
About when you were growing up, your parents were countercultural hippies in Western Mass, is that
Western
right?
Western Mass, right.
And that there were evictions.
Evictions, food insecurity. I mean, to be really blunt, I mean, obviously it changed in my 20s and in adulthood, but I would say, and now, of course, I mean, I'm, you know, working constantly. And in fact, I'm like ultra entrepreneur, which mm-hmm. is another reason I hate so many right wingers, because I'm like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking
about.
It's
another reason I like you, though.
I'll beat you on both counts. I'm a communist and I'm better at business than
right.
you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, but even until quite recently, I would say, you know, most of my life has been very on the edge that way.
Me too.
Yeah.
I've had a few moments where I was okay.
Right.
But not really fundamentally, but also when I was growing up. I mean, my father was always had a middle class solid salary, but my mother and stepfather, who were the real radicals, they stayed in the movement way into the 70s and way through my childhood. Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember the guy from the credit card company showing up at our house and like taking my mom's credit card and literally chopping it in half with scissors in front of me. And I remember like her bouncing a check at the grocery store and her saying, oh, well, you want to call the cops now? And me thinking, shit, 10 maybe?
Yep.
Yeah. Somewhere in middle school probably. But and I have certainly felt it as an adult, especially in recent years, you know, because you and I have sort of in the same position right now, right? We're sort of entrepreneurs
right.
in this space.
Definitely.
Definitely. And you have a podcast and I have a podcast, et cetera. And that's all awesome. But, you know, right now, at least I am not quite, we're getting there, but we're not quite to the place where I need to be really secure and really enjoy life. And man, let me tell you something. That feeling of maybe you might be homeless at the end of the month, you know, even if it's not totally real or rational, it is a possibility, you know, and always has been for me.
Right.
That feeling is maybe the worst.
It's a disgusting feeling, and it's an even worse feeling to be that way.
Right. Yeah.
And I have had a little bit of a taste of that. And I, you know.
Be homeless, you mean?
I mean, look, not in a proper, fully paid up sense, but definitely I've had the experience of, you know, if I didn't have the, you know, networks of people who, you know,
Yeah.
Hook me up with a couch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I think of it, and I think to myself, you know, my worst case was pretty bad, not remotely as bad as it is for
sure.
a lot of people. And I that's fundamental to how I view the world and what is and isn't acceptable. And I think, you know, those are where I do have really granite lines. And I don't think the delivery on a lot of those things is that complicated. I do have a pretty power view of those things.
You know? Just, I mean, I'm sure people have already guessed probably.
Yeah.
But just lay it out, like, quickly, just summarize. I mean,
look, we could start with just very basic social democratic stuff, right? Like, everybody, obviously, Medicare for all. I think Kaniella Ng's proposal of a... Yeah, universal social housing option is great, and I think that I think if you did UBI as a supplement to those things, not a substitute, it could be cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think a federal jobs guarantee, but I wouldn't frame it as a job. I wouldn't, because I think there's an interesting meeting point between. I think that people actually do want a sense of purpose and contribution, and we've reduced that to a job, right? And I would want to kind of problematize that relationship. But I also don't think, like, I think that, because I think when I hear technocratic Silicon Valley people talking about UBI, I think they're like, they realize that if they want to keep hoarding all of the wealth of the world and, like, making pizza delivery apps, they're going to need to come up with, like, a little tiny pressure valve.
Oh, yeah.
And so they think of this thing, and it's like, okay, just barely enough to survive and, you know, sort of not get too upset. The reason I like the idea of a federal jobs guarantee in addition to all those other programs, if you framed it right, and actually Jeremy Rifkin did this in The End of Work, which is a kind of interesting book from the 90s, just sort of like, I mean, and there is echoes of New Deal. Like, how many people do you meet that have every type of skill, mentoring skills, building skills, artistic skills? You know, they could, there's no reason why money couldn't be transferred to them, and that federal, you know, that federal jobs guarantee could be like a whole space of, like, mass contribution and civic innovation that was subsidized by the government.
Okay. So this is, I got to intervene before we go back to your childhood.
Yes.
So here's, there's many ways you can argue against that, right? But here's my thing. Do you want to work for the government?
I don't care.
The government of the United States or the New York State or any state? That's the thing. A government job, like working for the government, knowing that.
I would be totally cool with being completely subsidized by the government to do what I
do. Knowing that the boss 100%. Could be someone like Donald Trump.
Who is more of a, even under Donald Trump, in people's day-to-day lives?
Or Hillary Clinton, either one, right? Would be pretty disgusting to you, wouldn't it?
I don't think of it that way, but I would say.
I know you, like, don't.
I mean, no, because also it's like in people, it's funny to me though, because it's like in people's real life, there's so much neurosis about the government in this country. And government is essential and really important, and it can be engineered to be any number of ways we want to engineer it. And there's things that I would fundamentally re-engineer about government, and there's ways in which government under me would get massively bigger, and there's other ways it would get massively smaller. But on the other hand, like, I haven't had a single conversation with a libertarian who has a job, and ironically, in most cases, they all do have jobs. They're not entrepreneurs in most cases, with you being an exception. And I said, who has more of a coercive power in your life, your boss or the IRS? And don't bullshit me, like,
sure.
For real.
Sure.
Private sector relationships and the compelled need to do something, by the way, which you just told me you're crackpot, not you, but it's always like, you've just told me your fucking Bitcoin fantasy or whatever the stupid idea you have that you don't have the resources to pursue. Who's blocking you from
just that? So you know, you're alienating about a half the audience right
now.
But that's okay, guys. It's okay. Everything's okay. I'll take care of this. He's wearing my shirt. By the end of this interview, I'll have him with us. Don't
worry. It's definitely not going to happen. But just remember, it's good. It's good to, you know, it's good to hear, you know, socialism with balls.
Yeah, there you go.
I love you guys. It's all right.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah. But so to me, like, the coercive power, like, in fact, in terms of reality, government, you know, saved my ass. By literally, like, home heating assistants, mm-hmm. not going cold. Mm-hmm. The reason I was able to go to college, I mean, you know, Bates gave me a great deal, but I definitely needed federally guaranteed loans. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the actual rubber meeting the road. Mm-hmm. The private sector is enormously coercive and dangerous to people's freedom and well-being. And then I think there's a whole separate set of questions that we could ask that aren't appropriately thought of in those terms. Like people say, like, well, what about the experience of the DMV or bureaucracies that are alienating and big and coercive? And it's like, well, I agree with you. I don't believe in big, alienating, coercive bureaucracies like HMOs, like mm-hmm. insurance companies. Mm-hmm. Like, we could have a whole other set of conversations about unresponsive institutions. And I actually think there's a line of literature, which is not exactly my politics, but I think is very beautiful and has a lot of, I wish more people would read, that are like people like Ivan Illich, who wrote Deschooling Society, people like John Taylor Gatto on radical unschooling.
There you go. Now you're bringing the audience back. Well, now they're liking you again.
Well, that's a left.
Because we're huge Gatto fans here.
Right. Yeah. That's beautiful. There's a left anarchist, broader critique of alienating institutions that doesn't relegate it to private. You know, I remember libertarians like, oh, is there something magical about engaging the markets? Like, look, I don't want to be put on hold and dealing with some asshole on the phone, whether it be, a company or the federal government. And actually, in today's world, if you're dealing with student loans and things like that, you're mostly dealing with a extremely abusive, dangerous private company.
A bank. Yeah.
A bank.
Yeah.
So, those are kind of my mixed parts of that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm exactly halfway between you and the libertarians on all these things.
Yeah.
So one of my beefs with libertarians is that they tend to be deaf, dumb, and blind to the kind of coercion you're talking about. In the workplace, the boss becomes a dictator. I agree with you. Is a dictator. Sorry, there is no First Amendment in the workplace. We've established this in the court system. We know this, right? Right. You know, then the libertarian argument against that is a good one, but I don't think it's totally sufficient, which is, well, in a market in which there's competition, you can choose your boss. And that's true to some extent.
Not in practice.
Now, here's where I'm still a Marxist,
right.
Okay?
Right.
I believe that the working class are those people who must work in order to survive, right?
Right.
I like that definition. It makes sense to me. And most of us are in that category.
Right.
That means there is some coercion, some compulsion. You must go work. You must go work for this stranger you wouldn't ever work for otherwise, right? This is work you wouldn't do if you didn't have to.
Right.
In capitalism, in even a perfectly free market economy, not the corporatist bullshit capitalism we have now, but in a perfect libertarian free market economy, there's hustling, there's anxiety, there's insecurity, there is submitting to the dictates of a boss, probably, unless you're an entrepreneur. But for many people, it will be all those things you're talking about. I completely agree.
Also, there's no perfect. I mean, the other thing that we would probably totally disagree with is that their fantasy about some perfect market could never exist. And there's always a government institution.
Has been historically, yes.
But literally there is. Because even if we set this up in the future, there's still going to be a governance structure setting up the rules of the road of that. There's no way that you can have a functioning marketplace of any kind that didn't have rules of the road set up. And the question is who are you writing it in favor of?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yep.
I don't, there's no way of escaping that. And that's why the other contradictions about libertarians is it's like you have to ask yourself, especially because one way in which maybe I'm not capital C is I'm not a particularly utopian thinker. Like, I think we could have a radically better world with radically better human well-being, and I'm totally committed to that. But I'm also like, there's always going to be problems, there's always going to be contradictions, there's always going to need to be fine-tuning. In America in 2018, I am a radical statist Marxist. In the Soviet Union in the 1980s, I would probably be hanging out with Václav Havel and, doing free union activism. And I would like to think.
I think you would have been in a punk band.
Or I'd be in a... Exactly. And that's on the same continuum.
Right.
And in South Africa, I would armed with Ronnie Kasrils and the South African Communist Party, right? So there's one part of that. But that being said, you have to ask yourself, do the intermediary steps of where you ultimately want to go help improve the human condition? I could say Medicare for all is going to, in the context of today's world, make life better for most people here. I have no doubt about that. When libertarians tell me, like, there's this magical future scenario where there's a perfect market and somehow, like, you know, there isn't a Bhopal disaster because people are writing Yelp reviews or whatever the fuck it is. And then I enjoy ad hominems and I'm right.
I know you do.
And I'm pretty good. And somehow in order to get to this magical point where there isn't, you know, people have different court systems and private militias, but it's all magical and nice and friendly somehow. What we're going to do is keep deregulating the most powerful agents on the planet today, which are corporations. Mm-hmm. And we're going to allow them to own politics, pollute where they want to pollute, write their own rules for everything from human safety to derivatives trading. All of which right now in our present world will decrease human well-being across the board. But somehow, through a project of sort of secular theology, if we just kept doing that, it would end up in some better place. I just never, and I don't buy left-wing versions of that argument either, right? Like, I don't like accelerationist arguments.
What is that, by the way?
Accelerationist?
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Accelerationist is like make shit worse before it gets better.
Oh,
right?
That. So that argument.
I don't, so like, look, I think it goes, I mean, it's pretty obvious what someone like me is going to think of Hillary Clinton. And I totally pick Hillary Clinton over Trump because I've lived in those margins. And I know the difference in a rider in a fucking legislation bill, which people in these podcasts and everything, it's not exciting. It's not all the stuff that people, the rabbit holes people love to go down. But I know the difference between $100 million for a home heating subsidy and not.
Yeah.
And she's going to deliver that. So it's better she's president. Yeah. And I don't believe in squeezing, you know, because that's the left version. Is like, if you really squeeze people, there'll be a revolution.
Oh, that old radical revolutionary.
Total bullshit. It's not even borne out by left-wing terms. Like the Soviet Revolution happened when things were actually relatively more opened. Right. In terms of, like, at least in terms of a sort of liberal political opening. So I, you know, I'm not someone. I don't believe in a even on my side of it. Anybody that starts talking about a sacrifice now, usually it always involves other people's well-being, by the way, for a future scenario. I'm like, yeah, we're fuck out of here. I'm not with that.
Yeah, I'm neither here nor there. So for me, capitalism is a system of anxiety. And I don't see any way of getting around that, even in a pure, as I said, free market system. Socialism, on the other hand, is a system of depression to me. And I don't see any way around that either.
Explain that. It's
even worse, actually, than depression. That's actually more of a classical libertarian and classical liberal beef with socialism, is that it's not productive and that people get stuck and there's no incentives. I mean, I suppose that's all true. I don't think
that's true at all. We just expanded. Human beings are. No, I don't believe.
Well, I don't.
That.
My point is, I don't care about that. Let me make my argument against socialism.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My main argument. Is this. It requires nonstop work.
Why?
We all must work.
Why?
Well, how we have to produce stuff, don't we?
Why do we have to work all the time to do that?
Because there's a lot to do. Well, I mean, if
this is all made up, dude.
Why is it made up?
We could easily decide, and I'm not saying we would want to do this, but obviously in a democratized economy and more decentralized way of doing things, you could say, all right, well, we don't need a new car fleet this year, and people are just going to get more vacation time.
Who makes the decision? I thought socialism was economic democracy, and so we all make the decisions about all economics.
Well, there would obviously have to be collective decision making,
right? Which is work. That's the work.
You're talking about literally the work of politics,
of
like
socialism,
parliament,
of
work.
Socialism, of being socialists in a socialist country. It's everyone. Everyone is a manager.
You could still outsource
to whom
leadership work. I'm
the non-socialists.
No, parliamentary socialism is a totally viable thing. I don't think there's ever any. I think that there's never going to be a project, and maybe this is another way in which I'm not a utopian. I don't think there's ever going to be a project where there isn't some type of outsourcing of some parts of decision.
But don't I have to go to meetings?
Not if you don't want to.
Well, what? What if everybody doesn't go to meetings and there's no socialism? Then we have Joe Stalin running it, right?
No, actually, there's a lot of meetings. there was a lot of meetings in that system.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. They required people to go to meetings.
Well, you said, but then Joe Stalin runs it if there are no meetings.
Oh, well, you know. In other words, there was not enough popular...
But again, I think this is just another distinction that I'm going to make of like...
But wait, no. Let me stick with this. So I have to go to meetings, don't I?
Well, you have to go to meetings now.
Sure.
So the question is...
But what if I...
What are the...
But I don't want to go to your meetings. Right? I don't want to go to the socialist meetings. I don't want to go to the meetings to run the city or the state or the country or the world. I don't want to do that. I don't want to manage other people. But that's what socialism requires of me, doesn't it?
I don't think socialism as I conceive it wouldn't require... I mean, if you already don't like the amount that you're required of now in terms of your level of participation now, I couldn't guarantee you less than that. But I wouldn't see why necessarily it would need to be a lot more than that.
No, I'm just telling you, I won't do it. I'm not going to manage other people. I'm not going to make decisions for other people.
Well, all I can tell you at this point in the conversation is I will do my best to make sure you don't get shot when we take over.
See?
And I will have some leadership capacity. No,
so,
I don't...
So
I don't
32 minutes 32 minutes in and you're already shooting people.
I love the joke. No, I don't...
Well,
I don't,
there you go.
I just don't see it like that. I think that there are so... And I'm... This is where it is relevant to bring up like Scandinavian examples, not because that's where I want us to go or I think it's like a utopia, but it's like the melodrama. I guess it's like conversely with markets. What's funny is I could just easily use Scandinavia with some of my like anarcho-utopian communist friends and say like, well, there's an example of how in context, capitalism can produce some nice space and contribute it to, you know, contribute things. And the thing is, if you you have to have some type of cooperative system, it has to be like balancing civic, social, governmental, and corporate structure and private sector. And you can sort of produce interesting organic arrangements that way.
Right.
So I think that's actually a really healthy way of thinking about Scandinavia. Some people, it's like, the backlash to Scandinavia has gotten unhealthy, right? Like, it's like people used it for way too long as like, it's already done. These nice mountain kingdoms in Europe figured everything out. And then people on the left came forward and were like, well, actually, these places have a huge amount of xenophobia and racism, and they're homogenous countries, and we're a way more complex society. And there's some truth to that. And then people on the right like were like, well, actually, they're really sad because it's gray there, or whatever the fuck. And then it's like, okay, this is all true. And we literally do have models of places that have pretty successfully given us some roadmaps as to how you can balance these sectors and achieve broader human outcomes.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, they're social democracies. They're not socialist countries. So that means that not everyone, as far as I know, is required to go to meetings.
But, I don't think everybody's required. But I think the question that becomes...
But most people are. Because they're required to co-manage their industries in the most part.
No, they have union leadership. No.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's what I said before.
Yeah, they're democratic unions, but they're members, and so they participate in the management of their industries.
Yes, there's no way that that's ever going to be.
Yeah, and that's both social democratic and socialist.
Yeah, and I'm down with that.
Right, and I won't do it.
Okay.
I won't do it. I won't manage.
I think actually most people would happily do that.
Well, just no, I know, but I'm just telling you. Yeah. I'm announcing to you and your comrades that
that's
I won't
cool.
do it.
So cool. Have your podcast.
Yeah. Well, no, you won't let me.
No, actually,
you can't.
Most people would.
Not because you're not a nice guy, but because you can't.
I'm not a nice guy, but you could have your podcast.
My point is you can't. No, why? How could I?
Why not?
Well, first of all, I'm going to be...
Could, especially in the micro-entrepreneur space, why would we have
because
no
I'm gonna,
problem
Number one,
that?
I'm going to be subverting the whole... project you have constantly on my podcast as I'm doing now, right?
That's fine.
Maybe for a while. But
no, it's actually fine.
But more importantly, actually, I think, than that is simply the fact of me refusing to work.
You're not refusing to work. You're participating in the third leg that we just discussed. You're in the mic. You're in my world, and even fucking Zizek says this. Like, again, this is another funny symmetry. It's like, first of all, I think Doug said this on your show.
Doug Lane.
He said it with you. Literally, the marketplace itself is the least problematic part of capitalism. I would tend to agree with that. Like, the actual, like, exploitation of labor, stealing people's labor power and turning it into profit is a problem. Coercing people into work is a problem. The idea that, like, somebody goes to, you know, your page and goes, oh, I think that's an interesting, I'd like to learn about renegade history. I'll pay you $100 or somebody goes to patreon.com/TMBS
and there you go.
Wants this full brilliant experience of the Michael Brooks show and pays me $8 a month or $100 a month.
Just for example.
Just for example. That's great. And it's also great if somebody has like their little, you know, farm to table restaurant. I also think the other thing, and this is funny to me because I'm so skeptical of so much innovation discourse, but it's like, if you look at the world and the amount of human ingenuity there is, everything from reading about how a company like Exxon, who obviously I think is fundamentally a menace, but is still fascinating organizationally, to like the Mondragon, which you would cooperatives in Spain, which would freak you out because
I know all about them.
Meeting,
but exactly
saying, right. That would freak you out. Wait, and of course, much more dangerous to you than the people who are going to like eliminate your ability to breathe in 10 years. Makes total sense. But that being said, setting all of that aside,
I'm telling you, there's a lot of lazy people out there like me. There's a lot of lazy workers. We covered this earlier,
so
right?
Great. Start a podcast.
What are we going to do with them?
Live off of welfare? I don't know.
No,
and that's actually where I have more. Well, I have more optimism. As I was just, I think that if we let a space open, I think that the type of work models and the type of things that people generated, and I think especially, by the way, if somebody said, if their enterprise was at like. I could see a scale of business and market activity which didn't involve, say, public health, the environment, or was at such a scale that it implicated the types of things that I think do need to be more, you know, broadly accountable. I'm just like, cool, go do it. Why don't we have a totally micro deregulated environment? You know, outside of, you know, whatever.
I got you. So on on the lower,
you can't sexually assault your producer.
Right. So you
like,
have
like obvious stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
But like, you know, but whatever, set your own work hours, set your own pay scale, whatever the hell you want to do.
So you're okay with what's called a mixed economy. So you would allow, you would be happy with having some market activity in the lower levels of the economy.
There's no doubt.
But not at the highest levels.
I'm not at the highest levels. And it's also because of like, I think I agree with Bhaskar on this, it's because of a kind of, I think corporations at a certain level of power cannot be restrained. And I also think there's certain sectors that I just wouldn't feel comfortable in private hands.
I know
that there's some people who are going to be like, oh, no, full socialism means there's no this, there's no that. I just don't make statements like that. Maybe I share that trait with you. I'm just allergic to that. Obviously I'm far more sympathetic and I am a Marxist and I get where people are coming from when they make a declarative statement like that, more with socialism than libertarianism. But anytime somebody says to me, my political project means X, set in stone, definitive for all time, just don't buy. I literally don't think that takes us into the Islam stuff, for God's sake. I don't think anything is totally fixed like that.
Okay, so this is why I think political people and socialists and lefties in particular have no lives outside of politics. It's because socialism requires the political person, right? It requires the political personality. They all have been like this. All the major socialists, all the major people on the left in history have all been like this. They've all been very puritanical.
Nelson Mandela was like this.
Oh, completely puritanical. Nelson Mandela.
Mandela's not puritanical.
Of course.
Do you remember the story about one of the first things when he got out of prison and these workers made him a beautiful new Mercedes just for him, and he talked about how much he loved it? He went to an opening of a stock exchange. It was a celebration for having his face on the currency. And he's like, now this means you really made it. I can't hang out with poor people anymore. No, that's not a puritanical guy.
The ANC certainly was.
The
African National Congress very much was. So they,
in some respects,
they did not countenance what most black South Africans were really into in the 1950s and 1960s, which was jazz and Hollywood.
That's not true.
I
know that in the 1960s, at least by the 60s, the ANC used like Marion Makeba and they were the pioneers of using cultural diplomacy. And I know that Thabo Mbeki like hung out with Fela Kuti in the 70s in Nigeria. So maybe I just know a different history, but they did use music.
So Hima Sikela and Makeba and those people who were influenced obviously by jazz and American pop music, certainly they used them if they said the right things in their lyrics.
Right. Oh, okay.
Right. So, but the apolitical pop culture that was coming in,
I'm sure they would frown
flooding
upon
into
I'm sure they would frown upon
Soweto and Sophiatown, which was known for like being the Harlem of the world in the 1950s. It was this amazing place where apparently, by the accounts of many historians, many on the left, in fact, you know, it was a place where people were really into what was going on in Harlem and in South Central and in Detroit. They loved black American culture.
Right.
The ANC was not about it. And in fact, the head of the African Youth was the original guy, the African Youth League, I think it was the youth wing of the ANC, Lembebe, I think, and Anton Lembebe.
Yeah, I think that's
his brief. He was there briefly, but he was like a stern puritanical guy because he said, hey, we need a revolution.
Right.
And he was right about this. Okay.
And he was
My point is his analysis is correct. Right?
Right.
This is also why I'm not a socialist. So hang on.
That's another extreme example.
But hang on. He said, so what we need is a revolution, and a revolution requires intense discipline among the people if we're going to have a popular revolution. Right.
Right.
Completely correct about all that. And by the way, that's exactly what Lenin said. That's exactly what Marx said. That's exactly what Eugene Debs said. That's exactly what every socialist who knows what they're fucking talking about has said, because that's what it requires. So their analysis of socialism is the same as mine. It's the reason I'm not a socialist, and it's the reason they are, apparently. But that seems to me inescapable logic, that we must be disciplined and must work for it to work.
Huh. Look, I think those are very historically imprecise analogies. And I also think, again, the ANC, by the time you get to the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, first of all, you have a very broad-based ideological group, right? You have communists, you have Christians. So there already is actually a lot of space for kind of synergy and disagreement. And then they're dealing with a situation. And again, this is actually it frustrates me in conversations I get into. People need to know the conditions they're in.
Sure.
Yes. If I was in Cuba or I was fighting to overthrow apartheid, I probably would say,
yeah,
I don't know what this has to do with anything. No. In America in 2018 and in other highly advanced capitalist societies with the specific sets of conditions and challenges we face, like, Sorry to Bother You is actually a really important film.
Yeah.
It's a really important, it's part of a conversation. It's part of something generative.
Black South Africa was a prison.
It
was an open air prison.
Yeah, it was an open air prison.
For decades.
Right, precisely.
And so if I were living there, I mean, I would like to think, you know, at least I'm sympathetic to this idea that, I might actually pick up a gun and I might actually want to discipline myself and I might not want to go to the movies because I'd really rather live in a place not like a prison.
Precisely.
Totally down with that, but that's not socialism. That's just liberation from segregation.
Right. Well, then I agree.
That's totally different thing. It's something that
I don't know that it's a totally different thing, but I do think that those conditions are radically different. And I think that some of the things that are happening now that are productive and interesting conversations are, like, I think strikes are awesome. I think strikes are super
for any
important.
Purpose or for any reason? Like, what do you mean? Like any strike?
I think the teacher strikes are really important and really good.
No matter what they're asking for?
Everything they were asking for, I agreed with
100%. You mean the recent strike in West Virginia?
Yes.
Okay.
100%.
Which was what? What were they asking
for?
They
want more money. Right. And they also wanted more resources for their students, which wasn't covered as much.
Mm-hmm.
I completely am with those. And there's obviously electoral things that I think they're useful and helpful and important part of the picture. But I think like what's actually happening now is those kind of questions, like what actually makes sense in this environment, in this time to generate it. And some people, you know, I understand like the imagery and the ideas and the theories, and some people that, you know, historically I look back upon and I think are actually quite impressive and inspiring in some ways, but they're in entirely different circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So even from like you're using it to undermine socialism, but even people that are using it to try to prop socialism, I'm like, guys, we're just not we're not in that world.
Yeah.
So we're gonna confront a very different set of, you know, contingencies and questions. I mean, even what the Kurds are doing in Syria, that's fascinating. And I think they are.
You mean the communist Kurds, the so-called
anarchist,
whatever Kurds. They are, the communitarian,
collectivist Kurds, right?
With the women fighters and all
with
that.
The women right? fighters and all that, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was like, one of the things, and I'm not in any way. I'm very sympathetic to them on a number of. I'm sympathetic to Kurds.
Sure,
period.
Sure.
But you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, that there is a completely different historical circumstance right there. Is that they are incredibly socially media savvy, mm-hmm. and they know exactly the types of smart stories to beam back to Vice and people like me, and through social media. Hmm. So those things, which I'm not saying aren't genuine commitments, but they're quite strategically aware of what they're communicating to the world, mm-hmm. and that's already entirely different.
Which is a reason I would say, well, it's one reason I would say, be careful with the Kurds, right? Because I mean, I am sympathetic to some of what they're going through, obviously, and historically, but you know, they also require help from superpowers. And so they're when they're reaching out to you and Vice, they're really reaching out, I think, to the feds.
I mean, first of all, objectively, they get air support from the United States. I don't know if I think they're more savvy than realizing. I mean, maybe Vice has something to do with it. I don't influence the feds as much.
No, I don't think so.
Although I should.
I know.
Very savvy.
So where did you get all these crazy ideas? Because your parents weren't really political. Or semi. No, your mom was political?
My mom was fairly political.
Your dad was a hippie?
They're both pretty hippie-ish. Okay. My dad was pretty, you know. My dad was kind of, he loved Dick Gregory, but my dad was very, you know, my dad's more on the culture kind of side and he was very contrarian. So he would, especially when we wound up in that area, sometimes he would, you know, say conservative things just to piss people off. Right. Basically. Hmm. Although his politics, it's interesting. I mean, he's very, you know, like he liked Obama because Obama's a good dude. And he has, you know, certain, but no, my mother was more definitely, more political. My grandmother, she was a, you know, union worker at Penn Station. That's had an influence on me. My grandfather on my dad's side was a socialist who was in analysis when he was a young man with Wilhelm Reich.
Oh my.
And I remember I went and was visiting my grandparents in Long Island, and I was reading a James Baldwin book when I was 15 or something. And my grandfather's like, I knew him.
Oh my.
And like he, you know, he did. I mean, we weren't like close, but he was in those circles.
Okay.
But what I think it was an interest. How did I get these kind of politics? Well, partially what is funny is part of what I did, and I noticed this, it seems to me, across the board, is people base way too many of their decisions about macro issues around what annoyed them in their immediate environment. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you, and it's funny because some of the things like in kind of woke culture, I experienced like 20 years ago as a teenager, like totally before they were like mainstream things, right? Like growing up, my family left New York, and growing up like Northampton, Massachusetts, it was like, you know, it was, and I'll start with like, you know, obvious positives, right? Like gay rights weren't in question. Like there was like stuff that now is relatively mainstream was still like in the main culture. Like, you know, people are winning elections campaigning against marriage equality, right? And whatever we think of like, you know, bourgeois, blah, blah, blah. You get my point. Like it was.
So some people don't know what Northampton is. So
Northampton,
famously,
Massachusetts.
Famously lesbian town.
Famously lesbian town, famously liberal, famously. So
Smith College is there.
Smith College is there. So a lot of this stuff. I mean, and it was funny because, you know,
that was your hometown?
That was my hometown mostly. Although, but my family was all, I lived in Northfield. Amherst. Well, no, Northfield, no. Northfield and Shelburne Falls were not. Shelburne Falls was like a for real, out in the middle of nowhere, Yankee town.
I've been there.
And Northfield was like a WASP New England town. So I actually also spent a lot of time with a chunk of my friends and social groups growing up were pickups and shotguns because that's out there too, farms. So it was a weird mix of a lot of things. But I would say that, you know, I was, you know, plenty annoyed by sanctimonious soy bullshit.
Well, we do whey now anyway.
Yeah,
protein. Whey protein is far superior.
Well, yeah, whey protein is far superior. But I think that, you know, I was able to look at I remember one thing my dad did say to me that was very smart is he said, only rebel against us insofar as it serves you. And I remember being like, well, I can't really fucking argue
nice,
with that.
Nice, Dad.
That's a pretty jiu-jitsu move.
Well done, Dad. Yeah, that's pretty, an arm bar right there. That's a flying arm bar.
I was like totally like Rogan. I was like, damn. Fuck.
No, that is really, I was, love that. Yeah, that's that very, was, I love that it's transactional. That's yeah. my politics.
Yeah.
Do a cost-benefit analysis for yourself.
For yourself.
For political questions. On political questions, do a cost-benefit analysis for yourself. What do I gain from this or that other policy?
Well, I think we're doing that.
Rather than speaking for on behalf of other people, which is what political people of all kinds do all the damn time.
But
I'd say especially on the left, but everyone does.
I think we're doing that all the time, though. We're always mixing those things. Oh, I know. Everybody is,
and
right?
I think that's the problem, though.
But I have no problem owning that. Like, I'll tell you, like, so first of all, okay, so it could be if I fulfill, you know, the goals that I have in my life, I might be, you know, penalized by the type of tax system that I'll vote for. I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's a hybrid too. I mean, this gets more kind of abstract than I like to go. But like as an example,
okay, in
my self-interest, I find it physically, morally disgusting and repulsive that we have the level of wealth concentration in this society. And people and things, as I say, the basics, healthcare, housing, all that stuff isn't taken care of. If you wanted to get really cute with it, it is in my emotional self-interest that I don't observe that level of suffering.
I don't think you want to make that argument. Because, I mean, then you're just saying it just makes me feel better, right? You don't, you, that's not.
It's not my argument.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm basing it off of you.
Okay.
This is not how I view things.
But,
it's not how I view things.
Okay.
But
so,
you said, I'm just saying, even in the kind of space you're setting up of doing a self-analysis.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, like, what is the self? Yeah. What part of myself am I looking out for? Yeah. Right? I mean, that's another, right?
You said a fascinating thing on someone's podcast, or maybe it was your show, or maybe you've said it many times, that the problem, one of the problems with socialism or the left is that it's Christian or too Christian.
Right.
Right? You said that you elaborated on that. And I've been saying that for years and years and years and years.
I think I was saying liberalism more than socialism in the modern context.
I heard the left anyway. So when you said you'd be willing to sacrifice, right, some of your money or whatever in the tax system, you know, for other people, I suppose. I mean, that's a Christian ethos right there.
Well, so this is where
it is, right?
You know, Totally. And what I meant by it, and this is where I come into a lot of these conversations, I make a really harsh and clear distinction between, and by the way, to be clear, like, I think that anybody, like in New York City, anybody making under like $700,000 a year shouldn't pay any taxes, period. And it should all be like getting from like the oligarchs and the Wall Street guys, 100%. That being stipulated, I make a really clear distinction in all these conversations between material and emotional questions. So I think that the left, when I said the left is too Christian, I think it's way too... I think people run way too much with this, but I think that there is an element of the Nietzsche idea that people who have been on the bottom of the hierarchy flip the hierarchy and then use it to kind of like inflict emotional tolls on other people. Right. I think that happens all over the place.
Ressentiment.
Yeah, yep. I think that that happens. I think that there's a performativity to it, which is off-putting to people and unpleasant. Now, I think it's a problem really of politics. I don't just see it on the left at all.
And sure.
I think if anybody's viewing modern politics and they think that like the left has like unique emotional or psychological problems, I would.
Oh, I mean, modern conservatives are constantly speaking on behalf of other people. Sure.
And they're nuts. And there's obviously like a conversation in this culture that I think does just have to take place on just a much on, I think we need to deal with literalism of every kind as a variety.
Like, what do you mean by that?
Like, the difference between, like, I have no problem, you know, saying, like, I think that particular, well, I'll use a specific example. We were playing an Owen Benjamin clip on the show the other day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing some stupid bit, and it wasn't funny. And yes, it would totally be fairly called racist, right? Because he's just trying to get his way to use the fucking N-word and provoke people. There's nothing going on there. right? And I'll say that. And then the response of those guys is like, oh, well, you're a fucking liberal and you don't get comedy. And it's like, well, first of all, I'm funnier than you. And secondly, that's not what I'm saying. There are people on my side that just hear words and that's all they could process. But I could listen to, and did listen, one of my formative influences growing up was flipping in between NPR and Howard Stern.
Hmm.
Howard Stern walked to that line all the time.
Sure did.
I think mostly he was, in fact, satirizing those attitudes. I think that actually is what he was mostly doing. Huh. Sometimes he wasn't, but it was funny. And I think it mostly was. But if you're just hearing words, well, it's interesting because if you're just hearing words, then you have these right-wing idiots, which is like, well, you're not laughing at me, which is I'm entitled to being laughed at and no one should ever critique me in any way, shape, or form, which is really ironic. Or some people on my side, which is just like, oh, well, you said that word, so of course that's automatically a problem.
Right.
And it's not. And that to me is is this culture of literalism. It's like, well, what? Well, who said it? How did they say it?
Right.
Why? What was the context? And I think, you know, literalism, I think performativity.
And you've said also, you've used the word purity, an attachment to purity.
An attachment to purity.
The need for others to be pure morally.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I don't, right. Well,
it's Christian and at least in, you know, contemporary identity politics, that's very common, right?
Just right.
And demand that we never say the wrong thing.
Right. Exactly. And I use that distinction a lot to say, like, I mean, first, like, there's on some levels, like, if I'm thinking about voting as an example, I'm almost totally not interested in those questions because I just want to make sure you vote the way I want you to vote, right? That's totally secondary to me. And then on a more sincere and healthy level, I mean, then and then there's in the middle ground, there's actually like, well, how do you actually persuade and engage with people? Probably not by sort of freaking out at them if they use like the wrong synonym or something. And then actually what's funny for me is out of those two stances, then I'm able to pick a third category where I'm really comfortable being like, yeah, you're the enemy. When I see somebody on TV say, you know, don't try to make me cry about a kidnapped kid, I'm like, all right, you're out. You're not in my moral realm and we're going to be in conflict. Yeah, and that's totally okay.
Totally down with you with this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I love just knowing the enemy and not hating them.
I don't, it's not personal.
Exactly. In fact, hating the enemy, I was thinking about this on the subway rushing here to meet you in front of the house while you were standing in the rain.
It's okay. I got a kebab after you texted.
Okay.
Text
okay, good, good, good.
I got some Madonna kebab. It was good. Okay.
The free market in action. I was thinking.
I got it for free.
That hating the enemy is.
In Turkish place.
So that'd be anarcho-communism?
Yeah, it
was in action.
Yeah.
Is counterproductive, right?
Totally.
It just makes you less rational.
Totally.
I just want to know who the enemy is and I want to fight them and that's it. And it's not personal. I don't hate them. It's pointless. It's just about winning.
It's just about winning. And the different contexts call for different things.
Like ask any like sports coach.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, his team should hate the other team. No.
No.
Well, ask a general in the army, right? They're not about preaching hatred. They're just about getting the job done.
Precisely.
Yep.
Precisely. And the jobs switch at different times, right? And I think, and I think there's also the performative dimension. It's funny because again, in this spirit of non-literalism, I've had people, you know, say I do a joke or a voice or something that people don't like. If I get a tweet that says like, you know, you're a fucking asshole who's marginalized, whatever, I go, yeah, whatever, go fuck yourself. But if somebody, and let's be real, particularly if they're a patron. But actually, no, this is a good example, though. Somebody actually wrote me a message recently, and it was really like, it was about, not to disclose too much, but it was about using the word retarded, which I actually don't, I think that is kind of a mean word. I don't really use it. But in impressions, in character, I will use any word, period.
Or you do a lot of impressions.
I do a lot of impressions.
Of your enemies.
Of my enemies, and also people I'm fond of in some ways.
Do you? Oh, yeah, like Nelson Mandela,
I'm quite fond of. I'm fond of Obama.
Okay.
I have totally different politics, but I'm fond of him. Yep. But this person, they didn't like it. But the point was the way they reached out about it was so sincere.
Hmm.
It was so from a very personal place. It ended with me of like, you know what? I actually think maybe I should do some more content about that. That actually seems like an issue I don't understand as much. And they enlarged my empathy. And we had a great
around cool. the word retarded.
Well, that wasn't the
or
point.
Was the impersonation.
That was the thing that it was around that word, but it got to a much bigger issue about, like, you know,
about what?
About how do we think about people, you know, in that category, right?
Oh,
like how does the world treat them?
Okay.
And I was like, oh, it's actually a totally legitimate thing. Yeah. And what's interesting, though, is like, and that is actually why I'm also so skeptical of so many conservatives who constantly whine and bitch about this stuff, because I have been like, I remember being Hillary and Bernie. I got called sexist all the time. It's like, I'm not. So I can engage mm-hmm. with this and not freak out and not say, oh, you're suppressing my free speech,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not, mm-hmm. and I will deal with it, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time I was at a panel, and this guy was talking about how Hillary people were manipulating identity politics in the primary in a very crude way. And he goes, oh, I just can't believe you're one of you guys talking about this. It happens just all the time. I was like, oh, well, the difference is you're racist. I'm not. I was like, I can explain that to you.
That's an easy one.
Yeah, I got you. Don't worry about it. If you have any more questions about how you people operate, you can ask me anytime.
So, you know, I've been thinking about your impersonations.
Yes.
I'm ambivalent. And if I even begin to sound patronizing, smack me, okay? And
I will. I'm
yeah.
ready. I've been training.
But I'm ambivalent. I'm torn on it.
Tell me. That's really interesting.
Yeah. On the one hand, I love impersonations more than anything.
Right.
It's just my favorite thing. And it just never fails to crack me up if they're good. And the impersonations, the ones that I've heard, you know, are of people like Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, people that you and I sort of agree on. And so nothing bothers me about
they're the enemy.
That. It's just, I actually think strategically, it's not the best. I think that maybe, I could be wrong, but I think that it tends to be a substitute. I know you make incredible, I want to get into this too, like you make very detailed, sophisticated, complex, nuanced arguments about those guys and against those guys and against their ideas that are not ad hominem in any way. But I think occasionally you let the impersonation of the voice take the place of an argument. And I
right.
just, I don't know.
So it's not about impersonations writ large.
Your impersonation of Nelson Mandela, right? Obviously is sympathetic, and so it's fine. You're not arguing against
Because there is
him.
Just an element of it's what I of, do. Like, I'm... One ex-girlfriend said to me, she said, it was so funny, because she's totally not like, she was, you know, it's like Haitian, like Brooklyn, like not of like the, like not in this world, right? She worked in a totally different sector. I don't even know where she put, but she was like, you're half reckless, half Al Jazeera. Mm-hmm. I was like, that is actually really true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there is an element of what I do. It's like, you know, I am an entertainer. I am a comedian on some level.
Yeah.
So there, and so that's kind of the thing that I feel. I think you're probably right with specifically with regards to those characters. And the balance for me is that, well, one, you know, I'm indulging myself because I think it's funny.
Fine.
And two, I do find, though, with their a large contingent of their cultists, and I use that word very consciously.
I'm fine with that.
And
as long as you can prove it, which you can, yeah, and have. Yeah.
And I will say that I would feel, honestly, I mean, I fucking love adulation. I love public appreciation. I love it. I would feel legitimately uncomfortable if anybody sort of obsessed on my behalf
completely
the way those guys do.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you would too.
Oh yeah.
I think it's super
I do not want
weird.
Fans like that.
No,
thank you.
You really don't. Mm-hmm. You really don't. You want people that actually you feel like we happen to sort of interact in these unique set of circumstances, but I actually really respect you. I could totally, like, in some cases I have become, you know, genuinely like good friends with people who I've met through like the vehicle of like they knew my work, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that being said, they are, I guess, mostly guys. That cast of characters, they could hear a 15-minute segment that maybe is bookended by two silly voices and is in the middle is at least a well-reasoned attempt to agree or disagree.
Yeah.
And they just say, you know, it's out of context, it's unfair, you don't understand their work. So to me, it just starts to become like, okay, you know, like their response is that everything is an ad hominem and everything is unfair, including the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
sure.
Right? Oh, so it's sort of like, you know, so how much can I kind of kowtow to them. As I work towards this book I'm doing with Doug, I have the thought of
that. So you're writing a book with Doug Lane, Zero Books, is the big takedown of the intellectual dark web, right? Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, the Weinstein.
Brett Weinstein.
I always forget. He was just on my show and I forget it, but anyway. So I was listening to you on Doug's podcast, actually doing a really awesome critique of Sam Harris for like a good hour, I think you were. And we're going to talk about the specific points you brought up in that. I loved it. But then a couple times you kind of went into the impersonation mode and I cringed. Because I wanted you to continue doing your great work that I agreed with, right? And I felt like you're just undercutting, in a sense, my project, right?
I think in that context, like with Doug, I think you're right. And I think that's something I've actually already, I mean, it's not going to stop entirely on my show. And frankly, like, these clips are already out there. And if people want to kind of cut clips and whatever, but moving forward on those types of forums, I'm going to be more in Al Jazeera mode.
Before we turned on the mic, I did my own impersonation of Sam Harris. So I'm not saying never do it. I'm just saying publicly.
I think you're right.
Good. But don't stop them because I love them. I mean, just deploy them more strategically. Yes. That's all I would say. Right.
Right. Well, the thing about Peterson is he, like, because also, like, you know, when I'm co-hosting Majority Report, you know, I'm in the main chair once a week, but when I'm co-hosting, I really am kind of like sort of a shooting guard and moving the ball. And there is like a much more of like I got to pop the pressure valve. And, you know, Jordan Peterson specifically, I mean, it would be almost condescending not to do him.
Because he really wants it, is what you're saying.
Just even like the way he just hand delivers you. I won't do the impression, but like it hit me the other day. I was like, you know, like free pussy, but healthcare only for the rich. Like he just gives you like.
Wait, that's what you think Peterson's platform is?
No, not I mean, when you kind of are constantly talking against the social safety net, but then talk about like enforced monogamy and needing young men to have sex. Not what I'm going to write in the book, but it certainly works enough for a joke.
Okay. Yeah, gotcha.
You know, it's sort of like a, you know, it's just, I think with, you know, with Harris, I mean, I probably would I have to restrain. I mean, I really don't like the guy.
Yeah.
And
you know, right. Yeah. And I don't either. Yeah. And I think you and this is I'm saying this to both of us. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we need to chill on him, and we need to be less obsessed, and we need to let them do their thing. I mean, write your book and do that and make the critiques.
Well,
my
desire is to write a book that first of all has, you know, it really has to be using them as a case study to illustrate bigger things. And hopefully it makes a dent and cracks some ribs intellectually and culturally. And then, like, I'm done.
And they go away.
That's my intention.
Yeah.
They go away, or I'm like, okay, that's it.
I'm pretty sure they will go away.
Yeah.
If we just let them.
Yeah.
I think they're in the process of essentially hanging themselves. And just give them the rope.
Awesome.
I think so. I don't see it. It seems to me to be a fad.
I think
in large part. I mean, they'll always be around, but they're not going to have the following they have. There's just no way.
Right.
First of all, it is totally clear that most of their fans don't understand what they are saying.
Right.
We just know this.
We know this.
We know this. Yes. Okay. Some of them do, maybe, but we know many of them do, because I've had many interactions with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and maybe thousands of their fans, most of which are not impressive and demonstrate that they don't even know their guy's own ideas fully.
No.
Or not even partly.
And I know this is selection bias, but I have to say most of the ones that I've encountered who seem to understand and take on what somebody like me has said do say like, well, I still like what Sam writes about meditation, but I get that he has no idea what he's talking about when it comes to
that. You don't even buy his meditation stuff?
No. I'm talking about people who've given me the feedback who seems like they're able to absorb.
I was going
to
say it's the only thing that I agree with him on.
Oh, I haven't even read
it. Which is that meditation is good.
I think meditation is great. I haven't read his meditation stuff. I think we actually share a meditation teacher, which is super ironic.
Oh my God, that's funny.
It's really funny.
That is funny.
Really funny.
So let's do the Sam Harris thing. So you do, it is important to critique these ideas now because they are out there. Those guys have huge followings, they have huge platforms, and they're influential. And I mean, I think Harris is way more dangerous than Peterson, and I've said this many times. I think Peterson is just going to come and go, and it will have almost no impact. I think there's almost no impact.
I'm not entirely sure, but I do think Harris is more pernicious.
Harris's ideas,
yes,
if harnessed to state power, could kill us all.
Yeah. I actually kind of agree with that. I don't think there's any question about it. Private sector power. You know, I think there's no mistake that he's trying to be like a courtier for Elon Musk.
Michael, if it's objectively true that Islam is dangerous and violent, and it's objectively true that all other forms of civilization and society other than ours are objectively inferior to ours, and we know that the United States military can remove all of those aberrant societies and cultures, I don't get it. Of course, his ideas, the logical culmination of them is World War III. I mean,
I was on a conversation recently.
I mean, that.
No, I was on.
I know you agree, but I'm just thinking about the audience thinking I'm overstating it. But
I don't see how you.
True that other cultures are inferior to ours, right? That is clearly Sam Harris's fundamental principle argument.
And you're not saying, just to be clear to people that will freak out by this, you're not saying that Sam Harris is saying the second part of what you're saying.
Yeah.
That we should do.
No, he doesn't go there.
No. Right. But it's just to say.
Well, occasionally
he does.
But usually
but
he does
it's
not.
It's like a thought experiment or whatever. Right. But it's like, to me, I get very irritated. This also was the thing with Trump. I mean, when during the Republican primary, maybe you think this is uncharitable, but I remember I always thought Trump would win the Republican primary. Hmm. And people would say, like, really? He's saying all these racist, crazy things. And I was like, right. He's going to win the Republican primary. Hmm. This is the perfect candidate. Like, the perfect. If I was a Republican, I'd vote for Donald Trump in a heartbeat. So with Sam Harris, it's like, I actually flip. Like, when people are like, oh, no, I love Sam Harris, but of course I oppose the Muslim ban. And of course I'm concerned about civilian casualties. I'm like, why?
Makes no sense. Right.
Aren't you reading this guy?
It's incoherent.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
If you're reading him properly, you should totally support
killing
as many people with drones in Pakistan as we can and banning Muslims from the country. If I accepted his arguments about Islam, I would not want a single Muslim on the Western continent, period.
I mean, he has, I think, supported every single military intervention in the Middle East.
I mean, you know, again, he plays all sorts of word games. So I think he technically opposes Iraq. I don't know. There's another thing that really irritates me about him.
It does?
Oh, my God, dude. There was actually a really good piece by a guy, Merrick Sullivan, who I had on my show for a primer on Steve Pinker, which was a separate guy that needed to be taken care of.
I agree. I probably agree with you on this too. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's actually Merrick Sullivan. I'm sure he's on the left, but he's a theology PhD student at Oxford and like a quiet, brilliant actual writer guy. And he wrote a piece called for Counterpunch about Sam Harris called it was something like Quantum Harris, how to be in two places at the same time. And he just showed this Harris method of you know, well, this is horrible to say. I'm going to say it. Horrible that one would say it, but it needs to be said. He does so. Mm-hmm. And that's also the other part, I think, of him that does become maddening. Because he's so Peterson says things that I think are abhorrent. I totally disagree with and so on. But he at least does just say them.
Yes.
Right. There isn't this. I mean, he plays a little bit of word game in this, but Sam Harris is the par excellence of the column I wrote in defense of torture. That's an anti-torture column. And to suggest otherwise is totally defamatory. It's like, okay, Sam.
Okay. Yeah. No, actually, I think Peterson does the same thing, actually. I think
he does.
Neither one of them ever finishes the sentence, is how I put it.
That's right. That's exactly
right. Now, okay, you and I could be completely unfairly imposing this logic onto these anodyne statements that they made. This could be, well, you and I could be doing this, so we might be wrong about this.
Well, okay? Unlike them, we're willing to acknowledge
but
that
here's,
we could be
here's,
wrong.
I think, our argument, yours and mine on that. You know, it's for me, it's Peterson's I'm pretty sure what he's strongly suggesting is that we continue or live in a society that is organized around biblical principles.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see any other escaping that. I mean, that seems to be what his project is.
But he's never said that. Right.
He's never come right out and said that.
Right.
Same with Harris. It's like, well, okay, so Islam is objectively evil. Uh-huh. And period? No, that's a comma at the end of that. Right. Therefore, we must eliminate it. Right. I mean, So they never finish their sentence. That's what's maddening to me about both those guys. Tell us what you're getting at. What do you actually mean?
Well, you know, what's so amazing is that they don't. And then at least when Harris is pushed, the closest he gets to it is, you know, this kind of this battles of ideas stuff, which I, again, the other irony about Harris, and this is, I guess, at least, I mean, Peterson's weird because Peterson's trying to naturalize mythology and evolution, which is a very weird project. But, mm-hmm. but like, you know, Harris, so...
Harris, fair, he says, right, you know this, his argument, what he says is, it's not an argument, it's just a statement. He says it over and over again, we must empower the moderate Muslims.
They're not doing that. And that is
an objective, but that's what he does say.
No, that, well, no, and that's what I was going to say. So first of all,
that's like, his answer. That's right. To him, he would say to us, that is the end
right.
of my sentence.
Right, so you being on a podcast in LA with some, you know, Muslim that's part of your crew is objectively not doing that. Like, you know, this is where Asma Jahangir recently died, right? She was a great, she was a Pakistani human rights and feminist attorney, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and by the way, the type of person that, you know, again, maybe people criticize these tendencies in a US or European context, in a Pakistani context, total respect for the unbelievable physical courage and awesomeness of this woman. And, you know, but my point being like, she was quite literally a Muslim moderate feminist based in Pakistan doing this work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't even know if Sam Harris even knows who she is, mm-hmm. let alone mentioned her name. Mm-hmm. Or even somebody like, you know, Rafia Zakaria, who I've done work with, who's actually, you know, brilliant and much, you know, I'm just saying like, it isn't on the ground. And then the other thing that I do want to touch on that does lead to what I said with Doug, which is just so bizarre to me, is that it is, I mean, it's not materialist in a Marxist sense. It's not materialist in any sense, his arguments about how these things work. So even somebody like Robert Wright, I love Evolution of God. Evolution of God is an awesome book. And Evolution of God is basically just like, you want to understand why the Quran has contradictory, you know, fragments, and some of them are like really awesome and compassionate and open, and others are sound like really mean and warlike. Mm-hmm. Well, when Muhammad was writing the nice stuff, he was in an alliance with these other tribes and things were flowing. Mm-hmm. And then in this other part, he actually needed to invade a city to advance a political agenda. So the lines were harsher. Now, I'm not saying that's the whole picture either, but already as soon as you read that, you're like, oh, I'm in the world. Like, this is a human experience I recognize. People acting in materially oriented, self-justifying ways and using culture and religion as an extension of that. And in some ways, you know, and first of all, the book is not just about Islam, it's about all religions, because everybody, we're all Western religions, but it applies everywhere. We're all susceptible to this. And secondly, you know, it's, again, it's just like, it isn't like this metaphysical, Islam is like this thing, and it's divined in these texts. I mean, ironically, it's an incredibly religious and metaphysical way of reading these things.
He calls it bad ideas.
Harris. That's a religious concept.
Calls it bad ideas.
That's a religious concept. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. Yeah.
So, which brings us to this critique you made of Harris, and we're not going to devote the rest of this to Harris, but on Lane's podcast that I loved and I hadn't thought of myself, which was that I had noticed for a long time that he never mentions history. No historical events.
Never.
Ever.
Never.
Doesn't seem to be aware of them, or I don't know if he's deliberately avoiding talking about history, but you called that not only intellectually bankrupt, but a war on our way of thinking, on a particular way of thinking, which you could call historicism or...
Yes.
Contextualization, historical contextualization,
absolutely.
Which you were just doing with the Quran, that precisely. Kind of analysis of ideas, people, events, movements, ideologies, right? Placing them within their historical context. Now, I don't think that's the only way to analyze things, and we'll get to this in a second, but I do completely agree with you that he is at war with our epistemology, way of knowing, you know, which is that there are bad ideas. That's he says they're objectively, you know, you can objectively ascertain this, but whatever, it's just a moral claim. But anyway, And that's it. And once you decide what is a bad idea in the world, there's no point in talking about the history of the idea, Michael, because it's just a bad idea. So why discuss, you know, I mean, sure, we could do. So I think he would say, well, it's sort of like, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer. So let's talk about his childhood. Right. Well, why would you do that? We know Jeffrey Dahmer was a mass murderer, killed children. I mean, that's terrible. We just put him in prison. And he would be right, maybe, with Jeffrey Dahmer. Maybe even then I wouldn't agree with him. But yeah. He might have a point there.
Right.
But not with Islam.
Yeah, that's
not a, with
can't make
the
that
war on terror.
Right.
Not with
yeah. You're talking about
terrorism.
Billions of people.
Not with, yeah.
And it's just and that's the other part that I just find so extraordinarily. Yes, it's a war. And I would say on multiple ways, I think it's a war on historical context. It's a war on all forms of empathy. And I mean empathy not just in like the, you know, gooey sense that people use it, although I will defend that. But like literally, yeah. I did a project in college. One piece I had to write was in like the later part of the Bush administration. And the exercise was pretend you're an Iranian policymaker and write a brief on your nuclear program given the geopolitics of today, right? And, you know, I wrote it, and it was a very interesting exercise in, I would definitely want a nuclear weapon right now. Like, the United States threatening me, sure. I'm surrounded by Israel. Like, it's a no-brainer, and it's a real, it has nothing to do with, the hadith was not quoted in this piece. Okay, right. Like, this was an actual academic
sort
paper.
Of realpolitik,
right?
And it's so realism.
And what I mean, but realism requires
we need a nuke
that one occupy another person's frame of reference and state of mind to understand, you know, how things are working. And I'm actually willing. It's funny, in certain limited cases with Harris, like, I'm willing to get that even like with a group like ISIS, even if you could do that. Their methodologies and their goal is so far out of the realm. It doesn't mean that the answer to it is military, by the way. But it's like, I get it. Like, there isn't, like, with Iran, you can create a successful nuclear deal, and someone like Harris has nothing to say about that. I mean, I think actually literally nothing. I haven't seen him say anything on that. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that could be different than dealing with ISIS. So my point being, and then Hamas is a whole other thing. Well, that's an interesting hybrid because they deploy some methods, which I think, like, yes, I have no problem making, like, yeah, of course, yeah, suicide bombing, not right. We can we can collectively decide that all sorts of actions are unacceptable. Also, their political grievances are totally terrestrial and legitimate, right? So we can disaggregate all of these things, and we can argue inside them. But if you just hold the religious view, and I will keep using that word, or the Hegelian view, the just pure ideational view, that there's nothing that we can do in the real world, then it seems to me the consequences are either truly genocidal and catastrophic, as you're saying, and it could totally, or it could mean like you just sort of generally support bad U.S. foreign policy and then make, like, you know, smug podcasts in L.A., that are not going to help Asma Jahangir do her work in Pakistan. Mm. I mean, she never said it. You know, it'd be really great if there could be this roundtable with Harris and Joe Rogan, and they can all just get together and just really underline how bad the hadith is. That will really help my work in getting women better divorce laws in Karachi. Right. Thank you so much.
Right. Yeah, that's why I simply don't believe him when he says we must empower moderate Muslims and that's it. You know, it just because it doesn't work. I mean, there is no way that can happen. There's no way that can happen.
I mean, I think the way it could honestly, in a really simple way, can happen is like, look, you want to do that? Do a piece on Asma Jahangir.
Sorry, excuse me. It can happen.
Right? Like,
only one way, which is by killing their enemies.
From their perspective, yes.
Yeah, the moderate Muslims' enemies.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
That's the only way it's going to work.
Right.
To empower moderate Muslims in Pakistan, the only way to make that work is to kill their enemies, who are the radical Muslims. So,
right. But even that wouldn't even work because they don't understand. Like, I'm reading, you know, did you ever read Ghost Wars?
Yeah.
Right. That's one of my favorite books.
And Steve Call?
Yeah.
Steve Call.
I love Steve Call. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading the follow-up now, Directorate S. Hmm. And it's like, I mean, I don't have to sort of belabor it, but it's like to even understand. And again, all of these things are morally objectionable, right? Like U.S. foreign policy is objectionable. Right. To ISI is certainly objectionable. Right. The Taliban, all of this, blah, blah, index the obvious moral objections.
Yep.
But even there, it's like, what a moderate versus a radical is in practice is such an amorphous, like the Pakistani Taliban did have more of a sort of al-Qaeda. They kind of actually did morph into a much more sort of global sort of operational thing. The Afghani Taliban, who have terrible social policies, all the rest, of course, they really were from the beginning and up until this day were essentially like, just want you to get the fuck out of Afghanistan. Which, I'm sorry, even as far as I'm concerned, even a group that I will never justify or support or endorse or anything like that, and I hope people can understand this distinction, maybe where I'm like a little Trotskyist or whatever is I do have some belief that like whatever the local group is on the ground that's saying, please get the fuck out of my place, wherever they fall on the political spectrum, whether I have a high degree of sympathy with them or no sympathy, like they're my opponents, they're religious, right wing, whatever, I take what they say with more than a grain of salt because it's like, well, right, please get the fuck out of my place is not, that's an innately legitimate, in my objective world, that's an innately high value statement. Get the fuck out of my place.
I enthusiastically endorse that idea coming from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I do.
Right.
None of the rest of what they say.
Right.
But I enthusiastically endorse that point.
Of course. Yes. And then even understand, but even that, it's like, you know, just the machinations of like, well, is the Taliban, they say that, but are they really actually representing Pakistan? And then what is India doing there? And then how do you actually bifurcate like these totally different stages of economy, you know, these three countries operating at my point being that like literally none of those questions could even begin to be addressed by Quran is bad.
Right.
And then you get into the conflicts with these people and it's like they've owned this or dunked that. And it's like, I guess. You haven't dealt with anything. I mean, the thing you were saying off air, it's like maybe it's a certain particular game of checkers or something. It has nothing to do with an actual terrestrial concern with solving problems. And to the extent it could be, it has the type of catastrophic, dangerous, horrifying implications you're talking about.
Right.
Right? Like if you really operationalized it, like let's be like Sam Harris. Okay, I'll take your ideas seriously. Maybe you're right. Well, it would seem to me, as I said, bare minimum indiscriminate drone strikes and Muslim bans. Bare minimum.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. All right, we're done with Sam Harris.
Yeah, that's
so
it.
Once there's you finish your book, I want you to move on. And I'm going to move on too.
Move on.
And we're going to check in on each other. It's going to be like AA. We'll be each other's sponsor, right? Yeah, did you think about him today? No, not once. Not once. Did you say anything about him? No, I didn't talk about him. We're done. And then they'll go away, I promise you.
Beautiful. I love that.
I have a really important question for you.
Yes, sir.
Which has nothing to do with that.
I'm into it.
Do you smoke weed?
On occasion, yeah.
Do you want some? I have some edibles to give you.
What time is it?
Because I've given you a shirt, and I'm going to give you some weed, too.
What time is it?
As a gift. We have about 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Maybe three. Just to take with you, not to get high now.
Oh, yeah.
No, as a gift.
Sure.
Yeah, good.
I would be honored. Good. Thank you.
Second question.
Yes.
Will you allow weed in your socialist republic?
I mean, I think the obvious.
It's not great for the work ethic, is what I'm saying.
Dude, I'm telling you.
I'm telling you, you're going to make me work, and I'm telling you, I'm going to smoke weed.
I'm telling
and
you,
we're going to have issues.
You can
and
have your podcast.
We're friends now, but I'm afraid you're going to kill me someday.
I would never kill you.
You promise?
Yeah, I actually do. You're really not that high up on the list.
Oh, that's
honestly, there's a lot of people that I would have.
Meaning,
no
I'm
problem.
Not so important, or because I'm not so bad.
Both.
Or both. No. I give you the shirt off my back and weed, dude, and you say this to me.
You made me wait.
Nice. Thanks, man.
Time is money. I'm enough of a Marxist. I take capitalism very seriously.
You do indeed. Thanks for doing this. I'm sorry I made you wet.
Oh, dude, no, this was so much fun.
And thank you so much, I have a feeling we'll do some things in the future together.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I got some ideas I want to run by you.
Oh, that'd be great.
But I think... Some of my fans, I'm sure, hate your guts now, and some of them are probably interested in talking to you more because my fans are the best. And I had Heidi Matthews come to a Renegade University event in New Orleans.
Cool.
And
I hope she gave you a hard time.
She did. And yes. She gave my fans a huge hard time, but it was, they loved it. They yes. love talking to people who are actually true, principled, smart opponents of theirs. And it was a blast intellectually for everybody, including Heidi. So
there was a concept.
I was thinking about having you actually I would play that to. Role maybe next time.
Anytime. That cool. sounds really fun. I, cool. The last thought was, I think actually Hunter Mott said this. We did a illicit history on the social roots of innovation and debunking the lone genius myth. Hmm. And one of the things though that was interesting that I don't know how it can apply to so many conversations, or it can, but I don't know how practically it would. But one of the things I really liked that he said was that in just like more on the, you know, literal like corporate innovation and brand side, which I was a little bit around in my 20s, the understanding right now is that what produces the best results is a complete, deep, sincere and real emotional safe space.
Nice.
People need to really trust each other and really know that they have each other's backs and a totally ruthless space in terms of ideas.
Oh, I love that.
And that's the synthesis.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, it's cool. That's where it's at.
Hell yeah. All right, I'm going to give you some weed. You're going to give me my shirt back.
Yes.
You're going to go get your train.
I have a really nice shirt.
And I want good.
Hopefully dry.
Right. And I want you to have a really good weekend and not do any work.
I'm not. I'm going to the beach house with my family and sleeping.
Right on.
It's an Airbnb.
Right on, comrade.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks,
comrade. Absolutely. Here you go. Thanks, man.
Thank you. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. To get information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Thanks for listening.